From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, Sacred Biographies, Saints and Their Biographers in the Middle Ages. That's the topic this week on Soundings. My guest is a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center, Thomas Heffernan of the University of Tennessee. How did the telling of medieval saints' lives evolve? Who read these accounts, and how did they affect the lives of ordinary people? According to Thomas Heffernan, there are thousands of biographies of medieval saints. In the Middle Ages, they provided important material for the liturgy. To modern scholars, medieval saints' lives are noteworthy as early examples of vernacular literature. Here is Thomas Heffernan.
Saints' lives, or as I like to call them, sacred biographies, are the most voluminous literature that survives from the Middle Ages. They're also, I think one can say with some accuracy, perhaps the oldest of the medieval genre. In fact, the writing of sacred biography is does not begin in the Middle Ages. The sacred biographies that I look at in the Middle Ages have their origins in antiquity. They have their origins in the classics and in the Gospels. I mean, in fact, the earliest sacred biography in the Christian tradition is the story of Christ in the Gospels. Mm-hmm. The first saint's life, I guess, that we can talk about as a saint's life is the story of Stephen in Acts, when Stephen is stoned to death. And so saints' lives have their beginning in the very early origins of the Christian tradition and continue throughout the late antique period and throughout the entire Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And in fact, as Weinstein and Bell have recently shown, saints' lives are being written in Mexico and revered today. Mm-hmm. So saints' lives have a continuous history. One of the interesting things about these saints' lives is the fact that they have such a traditional pattern, a rhetorical pattern in which they're set. They don't change a great deal over time. I mean, obviously, there are changes at different times, different cultures, different groups are writing them, and as we get into the later Middle Ages, in different languages, the vernaculars. But within the Latin tradition, the important saints' lives that we have are written in about the 4th and 5th centuries. I'm thinking of the life of Saint Anthony and the life of Saint Martin. These lives exercised an inordinate influence on later biographies. They became models for writing later biographies, so people continued to go back to them and use them as paradigms for writing.
All right, when you say that they are models, are you talking about maybe a word like propaganda would be too harsh? Model in the sense of what? Religious content, religious substance? Are we talking about, is there an analogy in these sacred biographies today to what we call the self-help movement? How to improve one's life? How do we fix it on the literary scale?
Well, I don't know if the self-help model has any bearing on this, but in fact, they are models. The earlier lives of Anthony and Martin, for example, are models of both rhetorical strategies, that is actually patterns of how you do this, which to follow, and also they establish paradigms of behavior.
I see.
And this is an interesting thing, because within the notion of sacred biography, we see early on developing behavior patterns that become paradigmatic for sanctity. So that one way one assesses the degree of sanctity that a person has is to see whether or not they have in fact exemplified these patterns of behavior.
All right, and when you talk about sanctity, what we're talking about is faith, hope, charity, the translation of religious abstractions and ideals into ordinary human behavior.
Yeah, the translation of faith, hope, and charity, if you will, into behavior, but then the manifestation in these particular people of divine favor, because the exemplification of faith, hope, and charity produces an ethical response to the world. It doesn't necessarily produce a transcendent response to the world, or a sense of the world in which the transcendent is resident in the ego, and that is manifested in the Middle Ages. The proof of that kind of divine favor is manifested through the idea of the miraculous. So people that were just ethically good were not necessarily the stuff out of which you created saints' lives, but rather people in who the miraculous was. Saints' lives were read from the pulpits. They were read on the saints' days. We know they were used very extensively in the in the divine office, in the liturgy. And they also emerge from the people. And I think this is an important thing, that one of the fundamental differences between writing in the Middle Ages and writing in the modern ages, in the modern period, especially with respect to biography, and saints' lives are after all biographical,
right,
is the notion that of author. Saints' lives, though they might be written down by a single person, are really not, that they don't have autonomous authorship. These are documents that really, I think I would like to argue, have corporate authorship. In other words, you're a scribe.
Yeah.
Or you're empowered to take down this task, right, of doing this person's life. And this life is revered in this particular locale. You have a certain responsibility to that cultic world that the audience expects from you.
Well, let's pause on maybe one or two examples, Tom Heffernan. Name a saint and tell me about how his or her, the biography circulated amongst the believers and amongst the people who were doing the transcription. Is it possible to summarize in that fashion?
I think what I'd like to do is to kind of take you into that question through a little anecdote.
Okay.
To suggest the differences in the biographical between what you and I think is biographically true and what someone in, say, the 8th or 9th century thought was biographically true. And I'd like to use an entry into that as a marvelous little anecdote by a 9th century writer called Agnellus of Ravenna. Agnellus of Ravenna was asked by the Bishop of Ravenna to write the history of the lives of the bishops of Ravenna. From the very beginning, the church was founded by a missionary sent by Paul in the very early days of the church, up until, say, 850. And Agnellus writes a preface in his Liber Pontificalis Ravennatensis, the book of the bishops of Ravenna.
Goodness.
And he writes a preface. And in the preface he says, the bishop has asked me to write this history of the lives of the bishops. There are 45 saintly men to write about, but he hasn't given me any material to write the lives from.
So what is he going to do, invent from whole cloth here?
Well, I'm struck by your use of the word invent, and I ought to say this is not a rehearsed program, but in fact,
that's what
the
he did.
Word invent is very interesting, because Agnellus tells us in his biography, in his preface, and he uses the Latin word composui, which means to perfect tense, meaning just to compose, to write. But also, I think, in the context in which Agnellus uses it, it means to invent. It means to make up. Now, immediately, a scholar reading that in 1986 says, well, it's a piece of fabrication. This is untrue and not reliable. Agnellus then goes on to argue, however. He says, however, despite this, what I have written is no less authentic and true than if I had been given documents.
He's talking what, about inspiration?
He's talking about the notion of what constitutes personality, people, authenticity in the 9th century, and what we confront is an utterly different sensibility.
Oh, it sounds to me, Tom Heffernan, like we're into the area of what might be called historical romance rather than sacred biography, or combining the two.
Well, possibly so, but I mean, you see, we take as a given that the modern understanding of the individual is that the individual is at base, you know, if we can get deep enough into ourselves, a kind of constituents of ego, id, and superego, and there's a kind of conflicting emotions laid down in early childhood, you know, standard Freudian arguments, and
right.
I mean, obviously much more sophisticated since that I've described. But the notion is that there is a constituent of human personality, and one hears language which uses metaphors of deep recesses, characters embedded. In the Middle Ages, for Agnellus of Ravenna, if you could get deeply into the human, what you would find would not be somehow a constituent of human behavior, but you would find what he would call the imago Dei, the image of God. At basis, what you find is not this constituent of human personality, but the transcendent.
And in that light, Tom Heffernan, I don't mean to say that the stretching of facts and figures, but facts and figures become, as it were, flexible. And here we come back to this word invention.
Facts and figures are really to be then viewed, as it were, as enigmas in some sense, because the divine is always present, uh-huh. as it were, behind them. The noumenal presence is what gives support to what appears to be to us solid, substantial, real.
Yeah.
And so that real presence is always, as it were, being modified by the noumenal transcendent presence.
Mm-hmm.
And so the world is not just simply three-dimensional reality with a kind of substance that is separated out from a transcendent reality. And so when Agnellus tells us that he's going to compose a we, that he's going to make them up, what Agnellus is really talking about is he's going to talk about that which is most authentic in their lives.
Yeah.
And he goes on to tell us about that. He's going to tell us about what created these men, what made them, as he says, chaste and charitable and procurers of the souls of men for God.
Uh-huh. Were they all men?
They're all men. Yeah, they're all bishops.
Well, in this particular instance of Ravenna, but women were never the object of
sacred? Oh, no. Women are some of the very finest biographies in the Middle Ages.
All
in
right.
fact, I think my very favorite is the biography of St. Perpetua and Felicitas, which is a Carthaginian life written in 199. It's actually one of the very few lives that we have that many scholars are inclined to agree is perhaps historically real.
Mm-hmm.
Very briefly, it is the story of an aristocratic woman, possibly aristocratic, a Roman citizen by the name of Perpetua, who converted to Christianity and was sent to prison with her child, an infant, and her maidservant who was pregnant. We think the document was dictated in the Carthaginian prison, and that another believer took it down. It is filled with the kind of verisimilitude that we don't normally get in religious sacred biography.
Mm.
Sacred biography tends to idealize situations because it wants to talk about commonality and not individuality. In the biography of Perpetua and Felicitas, which is a martyrdom, they were killed, they were sent to their deaths, and they were gored to death by bulls.
Oh, boy.
We have one moment where she said, the authorities took my baby away from me, and she says in a few lines later on, and my breasts began to hurt. So the idea of the engorged breast, the mother nursing, this is not the kind of detail that we get in typical idealizing cultic biographies that are going to be used in liturgical services.
Mm-hmm.
The archetype for these female virgins, the Mary figure is obviously part of it.
Yeah.
But the Mary figure is complicated by this other issue, which is not nearly submissive, which is not receptive, which is not the handmaiden of the Lord notion, but rather this is this very strong, dominant voice that mm-hmm. one hears coming from these women.
Well, let's take that just another step, Tom Heffernan. We're talking about your project at the Humanities Center, Sacred Biographies. Did these biographies, these sacred lives, have... I hear a kind of a militancy in what you've just been saying. Did they have a political function? Did they have... maybe ideology is too strong a word, but, you know, in the sustenance of the church, in the spreading of the kingdom?
Indeed. Yes.
How did that work?
Oh, yeah, indeed. I mean, these texts were obviously catechetical texts,
mm-hmm.
and that they were used, in fact, not only to sanctify or not only to, as it were, to give reverence to the particular saint, but rather to spread the particular message
mm-hmm.
of the saint, of the church, rather, at a particular time. And they are indeed catechetical documents. And we know, I think, from at least if we now turn to the 13th century, after the Lateran Council of 1215, the impetus to write these lives was very increased. And
uh-huh.
we see a great spread of these lives in vernacular, in mm-hmm. English. So yes, they were catechetical documents. Now, it's not always very clear what the catechesis is in the document. That is to say, we see certain qualities that I think is almost always apparent, and one of which is always the idea of obedience,
uh-huh.
Obedience to God, obedience to Christ, obedience to the church. And so there's this strong notion of utter and complete obedience to the church,
mm-hmm.
which is being proselytized to these peasant audiences. But there are much in these documents that are quite perplexing, and one which perplexes me is the sexual one, which mm-hmm. I still don't quite understand.
Well, you have people going at buffets with themselves.
Pardon?
I say you have people going at buffets with themselves. You have that contradiction there.
Yeah, indeed. And I don't know what that would have given to a 13th century audience. I mean, it's still, for me, I'm working on, I have some ideas, but there is somewhat inchoate at this stage of the game. Yeah.
Tom Heffernan, we're talking about sacred biographies. You're looking at medieval saints' lives, your project here at the Humanities Center. Did these saints' lives have their critics? Was this all one sort of monolithic, everybody endorses it? Well, I mean, in and out of the church.
No, of course. I think it's a good question. They did have critics, indeed. The medieval critics are not as blatant, or their materials, their critiques don't survive as the critiques or the poking of fun as Erasmus's survives. But I can give you an example. In 1170, 1168, there was a very fine biography written by a man named Walter Daniel. Walter Daniel was a monk at the Cistercian Monastery of Rivo in England.
This sounds surprisingly modern all of a sudden.
Does it? Well, Walter wrote a life of his abbot and dear friend, Aelred of Rivo. Walter also was it seems to have been the monastic doctor. He would have been Aelred's physician. Okay. And he wrote the life of St. Aelred, and it was attacked bitterly.
Why?
Well, we have to reconstruct the attack, and I can't give you an easy answer to that, because he appended to the life of Aelred a letter to his then abbot. After Aelred's death, they appointed a new abbot, and we have a letter called the so-called Letter to Maurice. And in the Letter to Maurice, we have Walter Daniel defending his life of Aelred. And so we have to reconstruct the critic. We don't have the critic's attack. We have Walter's response to the critics. And it seems one of the things that they were very angry about the critics was the kind of miracles that he talked about. In other words, they did not believe that what Walter Daniel said about Aelred was in fact true.
They're willing to take what, miracles up to a point?
That's right. I mean, they were kind of skeptics. And it's very interesting because, and let me give you an example of what Walter does. It's quite extraordinary. Now, remember, I'm talking about someone who lived intimately in the monastic life in a monastery in a very remote part of England, in Yorkshire, in the 12th century. And he was this man's physician as well. He tells us he held his friend Aelred's head in his hands as he died, and he whispered to him a few parting words, and he records what Aelred said to him, and then he tells us they took his body and they lay it in, as he was dying, in a haircloth. This was traditional. Before you died, they took you and actually laid you in haircloth, and he was naked. Well, then when Walter goes to describe in his biography later the death of Aelred and the condition of his body, when we read it, we're struck that the last words that Aelred says and Walter's entire description of his dead friend's body is in fact not actually based on the facts that were present. But in fact, Walter, earlier I was talking to you about the importance of some of these earlier lives as models.
Right.
If you go back, you can see that Walter went, when he went back to the life of St. Martin of Tours, written by Sulpicius Severus in 398, and took the description of the death of St. Martin and put it in place of his old friends.
So what's
bizarre.
Your... Well, it is indeed, and what you're telling me after a fashion is that you are looking not only at saints' lives, you are looking at, in the strictest terms, literary history, literature replicating itself.
Oh yeah, indeed, yes indeed. Now, on the one hand, you say to yourself, but is this biographical? I mean, why would this man have done this? Why would someone who has known this man for half a life, for 20 years, and intimately as a doctor, have gone this and have done this thing? And the fact is that what he's trying to do is, I think, again, trying to teach us about what he believes that the fundament of human experience is about. That in fact, what is most basic in his beloved monastic abbot Aelred's life was the presence of the divine in him, the presence of the divine which he saw in St. Martin, and in fact, the life of St. Martin, when you look at it, the death scene, owes a lot to the death scene of Christ as presented in Luke's Gospel. So these things are all kind of, there's a nice word I like to use when I talk about these things. It's a palimpsest. In medieval manuscripts, parchment was very valuable. So that when you had something that was exhausted, as far as you were concerned with its intellectual merit was exhausted, you scraped. mm-hmm. off, and you wrote on top of it. Well, we today can use ultraviolet lights and the like and read, and actually read through a number of layers of text and read text below. These texts, these saints' lives, function like literary palimpsests.
Yeah.
That they're, you read through them and you see a history of mentalities. So you can read the 12th century life of Aelred of Rivaux and see the 4th century life of Sulpicius Severus and see the evocations in the Gospel of Luke.
All right, and this takes us back to an earlier portion of our conversation. What, instead of splitting or dividing or fragmenting the human sensibility, where we have a rather integrated view of it?
Yeah, I mean, oddly enough, it is. It's not a fragmented one. It's a view of human personality which is radically different than ours, isn't it? Because, as I said earlier, at the basis of human personality for them is the belief in the noumenal presence of God, not in this tightly understood notion of human psyche.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fascinated by this. I mean, I find this to be odd, because within medieval Christianity, the notion that God's locus is within the human is extraordinary.
Well, I mean, we have to wait until at least Ralph Waldo Emerson later on until we find something
in the modern age. The American Enlightenment, yeah.
How have our conceptions, let's pursue this a little bit more, Tom Heffernan, how have our conceptions of biography changed? In addition, for example, to this notion of the component or component parts of the human personality.
Well, I guess the earliest biography we have is Greek biography, 5th century Greek biography, and there is some biography from something of Xenophon's.
Mm-hmm.
Earliest biography was panegyric, and perhaps I ought to qualify that and say it was encomia,
mm-hmm.
encomium.
High praise.
Mm-hmm. And biography grows also out of funeral panegyric, high praise again. It tends to be encomiastic through the Greek period. In the Semitic world, it's quite different. If you look at the New Testament and if you look at the Old Testament, the biographical sketches you have there are surely they're encomiastic, but they're strikingly different. Especially the New Testament, because the New Testament is a curious blend of both classical ideals and Semitic ideals, isn't mm-hmm. it? I mean, in some ways, Christ is the perfect Semitic man, but he also is, it seems to me, now I'm stepping outside my area, I'm a medievalist, not a classical scholar, not a New Testament scholar, but looking at it from the point of sacred biography, it seems to me what you've got in the figure of Christ is a kind of blend of Semitic and Hellenistic ideas. So mm-hmm. Christ is, the Greeks have a word they called arete. Arete means the perfect virtue. It's almost an untranslatable word. It means to seek a kind of state of perfection, as it were. Each person, each woman, each man can seek the epitome of their arete. Christ is a kind of figure which is the exemplification of human arete. And New Testament ideas of biography are very different from Old Testament. I mean, one of the ways, for example, if you look at Christ and you look at Moses as both Semitic pieces of Semitic biography, right? You look at Matthew and you look at the Exodus. One of the interesting things, if you see these two characters, is looking at the way they interact with God mm-hmm. and the way they're viewed. Christ makes miracles, as it were, sui generis, by himself, right? He goes and he takes wine and he creates new wine mm-hmm. out of water.
And by contrast, Moses is what? The vessel, the vehicle.
That's exactly right. Moses is always, you always see when Moses performs a miracle that Moses is always kind of calling on God. God's always present to Moses.
Yeah.
What we've already gotten to is we've gotten to a figure of, by the time we get to the New Testament, because of the Hellenistic influence, we've got a different element present. We've got this kind of miracle maker
yeah.
on the scene. This is what the Middle Ages inherits very largely the mm-hmm. this miracle-making figure in the medieval saints' lives.
Tom Heffernan, let's conclude our conversation. We've been talking about your project at the Humanities Center, Sacred Biography. Does sacred biography exist today? Are you interested in that? How does it come to us in the 1980s? Would we be looking at religious tracts? Would we be looking at the life of Cardinal Spellman?
I mean, you know, a sacred biography I'm sure it exists. The kind of encomiastic and panegyric biography exists. I mean, you just need to look at the biographies of Washington or Lincoln, and I'm sure the biographies of Kennedy are panegyric, are encomiastic. And they will be. And the legends that grow up around Lincoln, Washington, and undoubtedly the legends, we're a little too close to Kennedy now, but we, you know, Kennedy fits these paradigms in a secular sense. But
So the model is still there. We have removed
bit. Oh, indeed. The models, I think, still exist.
Yeah, we've taken away a lot of the religious content.
Oh, absolutely.
But we've secularized them, but they're there.
Yeah, and in fact, there are still sacred biographies being written as well, all over the world. And they're very commonplace. We don't see them very much in this country because we tend to be very secularized.
Right.
But they're being written all over the world. And in fact, in this country still, as we've just talked about, people like Lincoln, Washington, Kennedy, these people, the biographical forms that you see in the legends of these people are indeed very similar to the ones that we see in medieval sacred biography.
Let me get real personal for a minute, Tom Heffernan. Just a footnote to our conversation here.
Are you going to ask me if I'm a saint?
No, I'm going to ask you if you're a believer. Does that make any difference in the doing of
a
project like
this? I don't
think
it makes a bit of difference. In fact, it could get in the way, I think, if you... it seems to me if you approach these things with some sort of pious reverence,
right,
you would not be able, I think, to really do your task very well, do your work as a scholar very well. No, I don't think so. I don't. On the other hand, there have been superb hagiographers, though I don't like that word because it's lost its real value.
Now that word means what? The writing of saints' lives.
Yeah, right. The writing about the holy.
Yeah.
But it's become a term of opprobrium. One thinks of hagiography and thinks of pious frauds and deceit, lies, naivete, credulity. The reason I like sacred biography is it tries to recapture the original understanding of what these things were about in their time and place. But we have had superb sacred biographers like Hippolyte Delahaye. He was a French member of the Bollandists. They did wonderful work. And there's many, many good studies being done by people who are, in fact, believers. But it's a non-issue, I think, essentially, whether you're a believer or a non-believer.
Thomas Heffernan teaches at the University of Tennessee. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Thomas Heffernan is at work on a forthcoming study entitled Sacred Biographies, Saints and Their Biographers in the Middle Ages. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Sacred Biographies, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about anthropology and ritual therapy in modern rural Greece. My guest will be Lauren Danforth of Bates College. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about medieval saints and their biographers. How did these sacred accounts evolve? Who read them? And how did they affect ordinary people in the Middle Ages? Some answers and insights from Thomas Heffernan of the University of Tennessee. Sacred Biographies, Medieval Saints and Their Biographers. The topic this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.